Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. We also welcome our radio and internet audiences, and we welcome everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. My name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly, and I am genuinely delighted to introduce today's speaker, Mr. Elliot Callan, founder of A Brighter Day. A Brighter Day was created to help teenagers deal more effectively with stress and depression. By uniting resources with teens using music that teens listen to and live teen bands performing in healthy environments. And A Brighter Day disperses resources on stress and depression. Sadly, the motivation for this was the suicide of the late Jake Callan while attending the University of Montana. Jake was one of those happy and involved teens like many of you with friends. He played tennis and ice hockey. He always had a smile on his face and a big heart for helping his friends. The Callan family and A Brighter Day charity thank you for being part of their family, and they wish you long and fun adventures throughout life. For more information on A Brighter Day, please go to www.abrighterday.info. Suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teens in the United States. And in this program, Mr. Callan will discuss the organization's effort in fighting teen depression. So please welcome Mr. Callan.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. Hi, I'm Elliot Callan. Thanks for being here. So we're going to spend the next 45 or so minutes just talking about what we're doing, what's going on in the marketplace, and then we'll take plenty of questions along the way for A Brighter Day and what we're doing. So I appreciate that. Let me tell you first who we are and how we got to where we got to. So A Brighter Day is a charity that helps teens with stress and depression, as Patrick said. And when I first thought about this, and I'll tell you the motivation for that in a moment, I thought, well, maybe 10% of teens are suffering from depression, stress of some kind. And then a survey came out in the East Bay, and it found that close to 60% of teens on the East Bay, I'm talking about seniors now, had at one point contemplated suicide while in high school. 60%. Now, that doesn't mean they were going to commit suicide, but they had thoughts about it or conversations about it. And I never would have expected that. So the motivation, as Patrick said, came 3 years ago in January 2015. I had a son at the University of Montana. He was a sophomore. He's a wonderful kid, but something went wrong while he was up there because I was one of those parents that was the last to know what was going on because he was just a good kid. He played ice hockey. They retired his jersey at the University of Montana, the ice hockey rink, for setting all types of records, but that didn't matter. So one Thursday night at about 1:15 in the morning, he walked up or jogged up to the highway, and he waited for a truck to come by, and he jumped in front of a truck. And we knew something was wrong because at 11 o'clock at night, when he and his mom had spoken, he finished the phone call and he texted her, "Mom, I'm at peace." And he shut his phone off. No teenager turns off their phone. And he shut off his phone. And she called me, and we got scared and kept calling him. The phone was off. And we proceeded to call him all of the next day. He had already been dead, but we didn't know that. And at about 6:30 at night, she came home from work, and there was a Federal Express envelope there, and it was a 6-page suicide note. And it said, "Mom and Dad, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I never would have asked for your help, and I never would have taken your help." And then went on. Now, as a parent, some of you are parents in here, that doesn't give you a lot of places to go at that. So just to keep pulling on your emotional heartstrings here, the next step is you got to go. It did say, by the way, Mom and Dad, I'd like for you to cremate me. And he actually thought this through and bury me and scatter my ashes in the mountains of Montana. And when I read this, I don't owe him this anymore. I now owe it to the living. I've got to take care of the living and the family and so forth. So we took a plane to Montana, had to claim the body, had to bring it home. And while we're flying home on Southwest from Spokane to Vegas to home, I was sitting there in my seat and I thought, okay, we're already a victim of this. We're going to be a victim of this our entire lives. Our son has committed suicide. Our third son committed suicide. So we either are going to just be a victim of it, or we're going to help other kids just like him. The ones that are not telling their parents, parents aren't taking the counseling because they're cutting themselves or so many other things that kids do. But they're just normal kids going through their day, but they're pressure cookers on the inside. And so I thought, okay, what can we do? Well, we could get some resources to teens. I handed you out some of the resources recently, and I'll talk about that. So we can get these resources in kids' hands. Twitter feeds, Facebook, Instagram, they're what they look at, what teens look at, which is definitely not what I look at, or probably what most of you in this room don't look at, right? And how do we get this to them? And I thought, well, what do kids have in common? Kids being teens have in common. And I thought, okay, they all have sports in common. No, they don't. I was wrong on that. That was my first thought. I have sports in common, but they don't. But they have music in common. And they have their own individual music. One likes rap. One likes hip-hop. One likes jazz band. One, I don't know. I've listened to a lot of music in the last few years. Some of it I can't identify. But they like it. So they all have music in common. So I thought, I know. I'm going to create for kids, I'm going to create concerts for kids. I'm going to bring in bands, and I will create tables of resources along the table, at each table, from all the companies or organizations that are out there, like the centers for different suicide help preventions, for whatever's out there, for stress, depression. There are plenty of resources available. I don't have to recreate anything that's out there, but none of them are reaching teens for the most part. And I thought I would do that. And I met with some band leaders in the East Bay here, the Beatles and Neil Diamond. And I talked with them, and I thought, well, I like that kind of music. That was my first thought. Kids must love that kind of music. Of course, I'm not sure most kids know who Neil Diamond is, but the Beatles, they would know. Although somebody did ask me the other day, if I'd ever heard of the Beatles. And so I met with them. We had a roundtable meeting, and how do we do this? And, of course, they said, we'll perform for free, of course. But they said, you're doing it all wrong. You've got to get teenage bands playing for teenagers. Well, we know what that is. That program already exists. It's called Battle of the Bands. Many, many high schools in the area have that. They had it when I was young. When you were young, they have Battle of the Bands. That's not new. But all the kids are going there. So why don't we create a program that we can do Battle of the Bands throughout the Bay Area for teenagers, by teenagers, and that the prizes would be so significant that they'd want to come. The performers would want to perform. And by the way, musicians, teenage musicians, stress and depression is rampant. Way higher percentage of people in theater and music than there are in, say, history. So we thought we would do that. So we began to do these concerts with the winning band receiving studio time, because what band, especially teenagers, wouldn't love studio time? And it began with studio time. They get 4 hours of studio time with a sound engineer, which is about $1,500, a sound engineer. And that was our first time doing it. And we just got loaded down with bands that said, wow, I get a free recording. And we did these, and they were successful. And we handed out the resources, different than what you have. And we put them in a backpack. So everybody there would get a backpack, and the backpack is something that they would want. They could keep the backpack, and it was filled with things like this, that they could go and they can go online in their time, at their opportunity, and they could say, help me. And they could realize they're not the only ones that are feeling this way. I'm stressed, but they can't use that word stress. I'm feeling sad all the time. And one major symptom of depression is a lack of sleep. And I noticed for my son, shortly before, when he came home for the Christmas holiday, I noticed that he wasn't sleeping between 12 and 3 in the morning. My wife and I were talking about this, like, why is he awake on his cell phone? Who's he talking to? He wasn't. He was just cruising the cell phone. And after doing enough research on cell phones, I now believe cell phones are the worst things we could have given to teenagers. They're terrible for teenagers because they make them feel like everybody is having a wonderful time but them. And Facebook for teenagers is a highlight reel of everybody's life, and they're not in it. That their friend just went to the Bahamas or Hawaii. Woe is me, I'm in San Francisco. My Christmas break, I was home. Everybody else I know was on an island. That's how it feels for them. So it gets them even more depressed. And for my son, and these concerts, people have said to me, are you doing this because it would have helped your son? I actually don't think my son would have gone to a concert. And if he did, he probably out of embarrassment with all his friends around wouldn't have taken a backpack. So he wouldn't have gotten any help. But we still want to help other kids. So in just 3 short years of this charity, we've now have handed out more than 700 backpacks to students, to teenagers, and about 200 to adults. And that's at no cost. So is that a successful charity or not? I think it is. I think it is. Forget the money side of it. I think from a touching people, touching teenagers, which is the goal. We just happen to have parents there. Our original thought was keep the parents out, but they were too curious, especially the band parents. They wanted to see how their kids were doing. Now the winning band, instead of getting the studio time, we've set it up where they get to do a live performance that's recorded with a professional sound engineer for up to 60 of their friends. And that's a pretty cool thing for kids. And they get the MP3 or the MP4. You know you're too old if you don't know the difference between an MP3 and an MP4. But the teenagers know that difference on that. So that's a great thing. So how are we doing that? And what are the successes that we're experiencing with stress and depression with kids? So we all know what just happened with Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade. Everybody knows that. I just met with Anthony Bourdain 6 weeks ago. He and I had coffee at the Oakland airport for a chance meeting. So I was on a telephone. I had just come back from New York City. If you've been to New York, and I happen to be from that area, and I'm a big fan of the food of the New York area. I love the food. I go home and I eat every ethnic food I can imagine eating when I'm in New York, including White Castle. All right. God bless you. God bless you. And so we had food catered one day, which was Jewish ethnic food, big thick sandwiches. If you've ever been to New York, I don't even know where they buy the toothpicks. They're really big toothpicks on there. We had Italian night. We had Asian fusion night. We had Hungarian night. We just had a great night. And so I'm on the telephone. I was catching a 6 a.m. flight to San Diego to do some business from Oakland. And so this is about 5:15 in the morning, and I'm at a high table where you put your computer. You've seen these at the terminals. And he's sitting right across from me, this close as David. And he's just staring at me, much like you are. He's just staring at me. And I realized I must sound incredibly obnoxious right now. And he said, and so I hung up the phone and I said, I'd like to apologize for being so loud. And he said, no, I love your passion about food. Do you cook? I said, I love to cook. He said, do you recognize me? And I said, I recognize your face. I'm sorry. I don't have a name. That's a bad thing to say to a celebrity. They get all bent out of shape on that. And so he said, I'm Anthony Bourdain. And we shook hands. And he said, you know, I'm on the Travel Network. I've been on the Travel Network a long time. And doing food and travel and interesting cultures. And I said, well, I watch the Food Network every day. He said, maybe you've seen me on CNN. I said, I only listen to CNN on the radio. I don't watch it. I don't have time to watch it. And he said, he was kind of annoyed with that, but we had a whole talk about food before we started to talk about his life. And he asked me a question. I'll ask you just that I'm diverging here, just to put a little humor in here. So he said, you know, New York has the best food in the world. It's better Chinese food than Beijing, better Italian food than Rome, better French food than Paris. He said, tell me why that is. In your opinion, and don't say it's the water. Anybody have an answer? I didn't have an answer. And he said, it's the passion. It's the passion. New Yorkers know that if they don't cook good food, they're out of business. There's so much competition there for the money that they just end up because of all the ingredients to make good food. So we talked about that for a moment. And then I said, let me tell you what I'm doing also. And I began to talk about stress and depression of teenagers. And there was a visible change on his face. He was anguished would be my word. And I said, we talked briefly about it. He said, you know, I've been habitually addicted for many years to heroin. I've been up open about that. And I've been suffering from depression the better part of my life as well. And I said, you know, I've got a charity here. It's in its infancy. My son only died 3 years ago. The charity's younger than him, younger than that. And I said, well, I would love to talk to you about that and spend some time, and perhaps you could find a way. And he had just said he sold out of his consulting business and made a fortune, and he was looking for something to do. He didn't know what to do. He was beginning to flounder a little bit because he wasn't sure, now that he wasn't doing restaurant consulting, what he would do. But when we talked about stress and depression, he just said, I can't be affiliated in my life with things that involve depression. It's too close to home. And a month later, he was dead. It's amazing what it does, how strong depression is, and how I don't think anybody would have known it the day before that he was going to take his own life. And he took a life in a hard way. If you didn't know that, he was in a hotel room, and he took out the bathrobe rope that you tie yourself with, tied it to the door handle, and tied it to his neck, and just released his legs and died. That's a hard way to die. It's 45 seconds of dying, not good before you pass out. So he wanted to die. I want to die, because he could have changed his mind. I'm not sure my son would have done the same thing, but he knew that he wanted to die, because when we got his computer, he had a website on there, unfortunately, of the best ways to kill yourself, a suicide website. And number one is jump in front of a truck. Number two is jump in front of a train. Palo Alto's got that problem. And number three is shoot yourself in the head. And don't ever shoot yourself through the temple. Always use your mouth, because you can miss with your temple. And there's a famous hockey player that lives in Lake Tahoe that goes around speaking on what his battle with depression, because he shot himself through his chin here when he was played in the NHL, and it came out through his eye. Of course, and he lived. He's talking about it. It disfigured him and left him a mess. But he realized that was a bad thing to do. But it took him attempted suicide to do that. So we go around, and this is what I want to talk about, what's happening in the marketplace. We go around and talk to schools. I go around. It's my son, my charity, and it's a growing charity, but it's still small. So we go around and we talk to principals. Now, there's a state mandate that principals have to spend money talking about depression, and they don't have to mention the word suicide, but they have to talk about ways to deal with depression. So that's a law in California. There's money allocated to every single school system in California from Sacramento. So you would think this would be front and center. Except the way the law is written, it doesn't say how much time they have to devote. So you as a principal say, this is really important to me because I have this in my family. I'm going to dedicate a week of mental health to stress and depression for teens and how to do it. But then you say, I don't care about mental health. It doesn't do anything for my grades of the kids. We get judged by how many kids go to college. So I'm spending an hour, and I'm going to do it as an outdoor thing during lunch when kids can just walk around to a handful of tables and pick up a brochure, and that's it. We're done. And both of you would have complied with the law and gotten the amount of money that was due for doing that. But that would have been pretty ineffective. And that's what's done in most schools, is there is very little education done for depression. So as I've talked to principals, some principals have been incredibly open to, yes, we need to do something. How can I help? And other principals have said, I don't care. It doesn't affect me. I'm sorry. We're not going to change the amount of homework kids get at all. I'm sorry it's 3 hours a night. If you have a teenager, you know what they've gone through with homework. So it depends. Now, I have a son who lives in Washington, D.C., graduated from Washington University in St. Louis. He was one of those high-achieving students. And he averaged about 3 hours of homework a night. He was all AP classes. He was a high school valedictorian. He was a bit of a nut. And he drove himself. I hope I wasn't a helicopter parent telling him to get good grades. I'm sure I was the parent who also said, go to a good school, get good grades, get a good job, so forth and so on. But he drove himself. And I would go up there at about 12 o'clock at night to his room, And I'd say, put the light, turn the light off. You got to get some sleep. And he would, except when he went to the refrigerator and grazed like teenage boys do. And at 6 a.m, his light went back on and he finished his homework. So I was driving to work one day about a year, maybe 2 years ago. And there was a speaker on the doctor radio station, which is one of the stations I do listen to out of New York City. And he was talking about depression and stress and teenagers. And he was talking about how most teens, high achieving teens, when they did a survey of these teens, do not look back on their high school experience with a smile. They look back with a frown. So I was curious. I asked him. I said, you know, here you had some really great achievements. You played on the lacrosse team. You were a goalie in ice hockey. You played all the way through your senior year. You won some state championships, some local championships, had a good time, you know, and so forth. And you got to do a speech at high school, on your high school graduation. So how would you rate your high school experience? And I thought he'd give me a B. And he did not hesitate. He said, Dad, it sucked. I said, what? He said, I feel like I was sleep deprived for 4 straight years. No matter how much I did, it wasn't really that much fun. And at the end of the day, I wish I did half of that. That's not a good way to look back on it. Is he the only one? You know he's not. You know he's not. So what's being done across Northern California for stress and across the country? Very little. It's not a very big topic. When I approached the city of San Francisco, their response to me was, we'd like to help you. It's a great idea. But we have a homeless problem that's way bigger than this. And that's where our resources are going. I'm sorry. The city of Oakland, we did a concert at the city of Oakland now 2 years in a row. And we did it in a place that they would not guarantee electricity. That's the area they gave us around Lake Merritt. And so I assumed there would be none. And turned out there was none. But we had generators. That's bad. When the city can't guarantee electricity at a location. That's Oakland. I don't know what to say. But they also have a huge problem in Oakland, and it's not that much different than San Francisco when it comes to homeless. And the resources are just being sucked up by the overwhelming problem of what do we do about this homeless situation. So teenage depression is very far down on the list of what's going on. But there are some things being done out there. And you should know that. So there is an organization called Teen Esteem that we work with. Teen Esteem is a paid organization, unlike us. They are a paid organization that they go into high schools and they teach mental health, or they teach suicide prevention, or they teach topics, just general health along the way and so forth. And they are getting some traction, but they're tapping into the school budget to do that. And so they're charging $500 to $1,000 a day, not a lot of money, but they're charging it. And they're paying the speakers $200 a day to speak. And most of these are parents like me that are willing to talk about tough subjects, or if it's mental health, they'll coordinate with Planned Parenthood to come in and talk, because Planned Parenthood does that, as other organizations. And the whole mental health program is 10 to 15 minutes per classroom, per session. That's it. There's not a lot being done. So what can you do about it? What do we do about it as a society in general? What are we going to do? And that is our job, and that's why we started the charity. Our job is to bring this to the forefront that there's a problem out there. Because when you have deaths like Anthony Bourdain or Kate Spade, you have adult deaths, people can talk about it. In my office a few weeks ago when Kate Spade committed suicide, because it's near and dear to everybody who works in my office. There's a little area of my office that is dedicated to my son who passed away. I have to keep reminding myself I have 2 other kids that are very alive and deserve dad's attention, because you don't want to be just on that side of the fence. But they see it every day. They see me working with this. They help do paperwork. They help do meetings on this. When Kate Spade died, we shut the office down for about an hour, and people came in my office and just started to cry because they just couldn't believe somebody that they knew who was a public speaker on motivation even had that many demons, which she did at the end. It came out. But they just couldn't believe it. And then somebody else in the school, the local school, died. And we just had a student in Danville that was found dead in a pool that they believe, they're not sure, they believe it was suicide. He just kind of turned himself upside down, took some pills, turned himself upside down and drowned himself. They believe that. There's an argument going on about liability here and whether that really happened. So what can we do here, again, is we have to get out and give a message here that it's okay for your teenager to be depressed, but it's not okay to do nothing about it. You've got to get them some help. So what I handed out a little bit are the resources in there. There are three articles that are in there at your convenience to read them. There are three articles. Does everybody have them? Anybody need them? About what to do if your teenager is depressed. So one of the articles is written from the point of view is, I'm a teenager. Am I feeling this way? And if you read that, some of you can you remember back to when you were a teenager? You're kind of still a teenager, right? Can you remember back when you were a teenager, when you just felt sad? Let me ask you a question as parents. What's the difference between a sad teenager and a dumb teenager? And I don't mean dumb in a bad way, because I have kids, you know, they say boys are 15, they're dumb. They're just stupid, especially now. They're stupider than when we were 15. So what's the difference? It's a fine line, isn't it? How do I tell my teenager is depressed versus just being a dumb, ordinary teenager? I'm an ordinary teenager. I'm self-absorbed. I don't know anybody else is alive besides myself. I didn't even notice that, Dad, that you were gaining weight and getting gray hair, because I don't care, because it's about me, right? All that. So it's hard to tell that. And I look back at my own world with my parents, and my parents are the child of immigrants here, and I have a mother who was in Auschwitz, which is a whole other story about how you deal with children of concentration camp survivors, or kind of another psychology chapter there. For them, they looked at me as, I can't wait for you to get past the teenage years, because you're just kind of stupid. You're just kind of a dumb teenager. And that's the phrase they used. But I don't remember being sad, but I remember doing really some dumb things that could have caused a lot of harm to myself. And that's, again, where's that line of smart and depressed, or dumb and depressed meet, or where they meet, and where do they cross? So we put that in there, or is your teenager feeling that way? And then we put another article in there, very similar. Is somebody you know feeling this way? Because what do you do about it? So most teenagers, we've learned, don't tell their friends that they're feeling sad. They would never share that. Maybe one friend they share that with, but most do not. But they do notice, their friends do notice pattern changes. And I'll tell you about a pattern change in my own son that some friends noticed, but they didn't share it. They didn't do anything about it. So what do you say to that person? How do you get them help? And it's so easy nowadays, because you could just pick up your cell phone and dial 211 and you will get help, instant help. They'll ask you questions. If you're a parent, you can call 211 and say, my child is in a bad place. I'm worried about them hurting themselves. And you can get help with a local psychologist. You'll be at a psychologist's office in 48 hours if that's what you need in emergency care, without having to drive the person crazy. You could text to a helpline to get help. You can go to a Facebook or a website and get some help. But it can, again, a 211 is instant. Those didn't exist a few years ago. And it's very interesting. That's done county by county. And some counties are very into it. Some counties are not. I'm not sure about San Francisco. But I could tell you Contra Costa County has just recently adopted 211 for teens. Before that, they sent you somewhere else, which is terrible. But they have a new director. Alameda County embraces 211 for teens. They answer that call. They have two people there 24/7 for teens, which is great. So it depends on the county. Your children's friends will notice a pattern change. So a year after my son died, we did something called an unveiling, where you take out the plaque on the ground at the cemetery, you open it up, and people come and they mourn again, and you maybe give some speeches and you have lunch afterwards. And it's to create some sense of finality that people want to stop mourning at that point. A year has gone by. For a parent's world, that world doesn't go 1 year or 1 week. It's every day. He's my screensaver. It's every day. I talk about him here. It just doesn't go away. Talking about it becomes easier, not living with it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So, there were students that came up to me at the unveiling. We had about 400 people or so at the funeral and maybe 200 people at the unveiling. A lot of teens, his teammates. Kids came down from the University of Montana to be part of this, which was very nice. And one of the kids, one of this group of friends who are journalism majors, said, you know, Mr. Callen, can we interview you? Because we're trying to write a paper about depression and teens and Jake, what happened. And we'd like to interview you. And my ex-wife said, no, she just emotionally couldn't get through the interview. And I said, absolutely. And so we sat there at Noah's Bagels before the whole unveiling began. And they asked a few questions, but it was more of an apology tour than it was questions. They wanted to apologize for not doing anything about the symptoms that they now recognized. And I said, I felt like my job was to let them off the hook. You're free. You go away, live a good life, healthy life, and be healthy and be good parents one day. But I asked them, what symptoms did you see more than anything else? And he said, we noticed that after a hockey game, when Jake would finish a game, and he had some games where he scored 3, 5, even a few games where he scored 7 goals in a game. That's tremendous. If you know hockey, that's a big number. That's just, you don't hear about that. And he was just tearing up the division there and having a good time doing it. And he said, when he went to the locker room to change, he sat by himself. Instead of enjoying that moment where he just had a great game and they won and with his teammates and they could fool around. And if you ever play team sports, there's a locker room is a great place to be when you win. Not as much fun when you lose. But for kids, especially teenagers, they horse around, they do headlocks with each other, or they dump soda on each other's hair and make it all sticky, you know, for the fun of it. 7-Up on your hair. I had that done a lot to me. Turned your hair into some spiky thing that you could have fun with. And he said, but he sat by himself. So that was the group of kids they played hockey with, said he sat alone. Instead of enjoying it, he couldn't enjoy it. He sat alone. And the other one was, the few kids said that when they went out a lot of times and they wanted him to join us towards the very end, he was wanting to sleep while they were awake and he was awake when they were asleep. His patterns were broken. Sleep patterns are a huge indicator of depression. And the worse the pattern, the closer they're going to get to the black hole of depression where they can't get out of it. And that's what suicide, I believe, is. I'm not a psychiatrist here, I'll tell you that, but I believe that for suicide, for people going into suicide, think about suicide, they're in a box. They're in this room, and the room is all black. The walls, the floor, everything, the ceiling is black, and it's getting blacker, and it's getting a little smaller each day. And they reach the point of saying, this is really bad. My life is awful. My world is black. Tomorrow it's going to be the same way. Next week it's going to be the same way after that. It's not any better. Why bother? No one really cares anyway. And that's it. That's the decision that's just been made. And I believe they get to that point. But if you can recognize and teach people to recognize that loss of the need to live, where tomorrow is a better day, because everybody is sitting in here thinking tomorrow is a better day than today. Because that's how we've been trained. We're wired as people to think opportunity is in front of us and not behind us. Because if it's behind us, it's just too sad. I can't think, I have nothing to look forward to. That's a terrible place to be in life. So generally, we're not those kind of people. We look forward to tomorrow. We look forward to going home to say hi to somebody, whether it be a pet or a person. we're excited about that. And tomorrow I'll come back to work. Maybe it's mundane and maybe it's exciting, but it's going to be better than today. And I'll look forward to this weekend because I want to do something fun this weekend. As simple as taking my dog for a new walk at a park. We live in California. You got lots of things you could do. But the person is in that black hole. It's not better tomorrow. It's the same or worse. And that's what we have to look for. So school-wise, what are we going to do? This is where we need your help. This is where we as a charity are enlisting you for help. Because we can only go as far as our arms and legs go. So I am going around speaking to Rotary clubs and to organizations like the Commonwealth Club, where there are smart people who are well-connected that come to these organizations and say, you know, thank you for not asking me for money. Everybody here asks for money when it's a charity. You can go to my website and donate, but that's not what I really want to say. What we need is we need arms and legs of people who have contacts. Contacts in school, contacts in communities. I just met with a music teacher in Alameda who said, I think I can put four or five bands together. Would you be willing to do your charity? Because our cost to run a charity is not very high. We're not the United Way with 30% going to overhead or almost nothing in overhead. Our cost is setting up the concerts, advertising it to get the kids there, advertising to get the band there, so marketing cost, and then the giveaways, backpacks, at $3.5, $4, $5 a backpack and the materials, and everything else comes from volunteers. But how do you get into the school system here? How do you get into the area to do concerts if you don't have the contacts to do it? You do it with arms and legs of people who do have contacts and people who share a vision that says, yes, I'd like to make a difference. I want to be part of that. And so that's where we ask for help from people. Show us how, and you can, and you've got my email on there. Show us how we can. Where I want to show you how you can to get into the to Burlingame, to get into Oakland, to get into areas because you can make a difference, and we are making a difference. I have two letters on my desk from students, teenagers, that say thank you for saving my life. I went and got help because of you. So it's a, yeah, it's a passive program, meaning that if you need help. We're not hiring psychologists, psychiatrists, and so forth. We're not those people. But we can give you the resources to connect you to them, which is different than other organizations. We're not asking for the schools to say, open your checkbook. We want to tap into your budget. We're all self-funded. We're just trying to get people to recognize that there's a need out there and that to do something about it. So let me stop for a moment and ask some questions. Answer some questions.
Yes, if anybody has a question, you know, okay.
Hi, great talk. Could you talk a little bit about suicide hotlines? Or what does the, if somebody were to call in, what's the conversation like and what's the process?
Great, that's a great question. Okay, so it's different, again, county to county. So now the Contra Costa and Alameda are working together. So when you could call in. Typically, you call a 211 number. That's what typically what you call it, or text it. If you walk into these crisis centers, there is a television screen on there that's listing. There's a phone number, and then there's a person answering that call. So they can see John's on the phone on line one. And so they are trained. They're all trained. They are way better than I would be to do it. I'm not a crisis person. They are trained to ask questions. What's going on with you? Where are you? What are you feeling? Are you thinking about hurting yourself? Are you sitting on your bed? Or are you in a car? You know, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Or thinking about hurting yourself and others? They want to make sure you're not thinking about going out in a blaze of glory, which is way too popular nowadays. So they're going to ask you a series of questions. Now, if you're under age 18, what they try to do is get you the help you need by saying, can I email you some places to go? Can I email your parents? Probably the parents don't know. We've got to get you some help to talk to somebody. That's a real challenge when you're a teenager, because when you're 18 or above, they're going to say, let me send those to you and make the call. Do you want me to call for you? And they can do that because you're 18 and over. When you're a minor, it's a lot tougher because your parents aren't aware of this, and parents haven't given permission for somebody to give out a psychologist's name to your child. But they're trained to do that. And they're going to try to talk you into, if you're at a crisis at this moment, they're going to try to talk you down a notch. That call could be 30 minutes to an hour. And then the next step is, can I talk to one of your parents? Would you be okay if I gave your parent or parent the phone, two names to call tomorrow? Can I call them for you? Can I make you an appointment while you're on hold? And they, some of them are really, really good about that. So if you're a teenager calling 211, you're probably in a crisis at that moment. And they're going to take you off the ledge. And then they're going to try to get you help. But unfortunately, we live in that world that if you're a teenager and you're 16 or 15, we have to include your parent on that. That's the law. You can't just do this around the parents. Imagine that going around. You don't want anybody going around you. You want to know what's going on. So that's what we, that's what they do. But the first thing always is talk you off the ledge. And if you're reaching out, you're already in a better spot than, let's say, my son was, who wrote a six-page suicide note, probably over 2 or 3 days. And so he didn't, so we, when I talked to my son's girlfriend, he said he had a girlfriend too. And they had just recently broken up. Maybe that led to it. But he broke up with her. She had said to him, she said, he talked to me Tuesday. And he said, I can't talk to you for the rest of the week. I've really got some things I've got to put in order. And she didn't understand. Of course, Thursday night was his last night. So he was already trying to close chapters in his life at the same time. And so if you're calling 211, you haven't closed the door yet. And that's the good news. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. Are there any?
Yeah. Yeah. My daughter went to Pali, and one of my friends, Kathleen Blanchard's son, was one of the kids that stepped in front of the train. Mm. I was really lucky. My daughter said, you know, Mom, I'm thinking of stepping into traffic. And I'm so lucky she happened to tell me that. But what I did is I took her out of high school. I just didn't want the risk, especially since my friend had lost her son. And both Kathleen and I came up to San Francisco because the San Francisco public schools actually spend several million dollars a year on their wellness program, where they have a psychologist at each of the schools. The wellness program, it's where you come for your condoms, it's where you come for everything else. But the teachers often refer kids in when they start seeing of the effects you've seen. The public schools here have a massively lower suicide rate than the private schools here. Even our really pressured Lowell, that is very similar to Pali. And Kathleen and I worked hard. We managed to get some people to speak to the director up here from Palo Alto. But at first they were like, oh, we don't have a problem here. There's just a few mentally ill kids. And we had 5 suicides in 1 year in front of the same train. And so it wasn't just the kids. But we have now imported that down into Palo Alto. But just so you know, whether we have homeless or not, for the last 20 years almost, the children's fund coming out of the mayor's office, because this is an expensive program, they have this in every high school.
That's great.
But if you wanted to coordinate with them,
I would love to.
I think they would be very pleased to put on, because they're financially strapped too, but if you can do it for free as an adjunct to what they're doing, I think it would be very helpful.
We'd love that. Absolutely.
And their director would be very sympathetic to it.
Yes.
Well, you touched on educating the friends of your son or people to see the warning signs in that kind of a scenario, I guess, as opposed to those who are actually thinking about it themselves, but to see the landscape. I'm curious with your two other kids. We have this in our family where there's two other kids that are alive and healthy and missing a brother. I'm concerned for them, I guess. And is this kind of program, it's probably not focused on them as much as just be aware, but can you speak to that a little bit?
It is. It's interesting. And now that my two other children are twins, it's a really interesting study. Boy, girl, twins. And they're 24. So they've been out of college now for 2 years. So my daughter wears every emotion on her sleeve. And she talks about it. She'll cry about it. She just gave joint Toastmasters, and her icebreaker speech was about how her brother's suicide has changed her life forever. And she's able to talk about it. And she's very passionate about trying to make a difference and go around, and she'll speak to mental health organizations. She's good about that. She's not afraid to talk to anybody about it. I'm very proud of her for what she does. And she belongs in New York because she scares people in California. She's so outspoken. My son couldn't be more different. We just were in Denver for the weekend. All of us, Father's Day, we all met in Denver. Last year we did San Diego. It's kind of a Father's Day weekend, so we can just get away and be ourselves. And we talked to him. We kind of beat him up a little bit. And we talked to him, and only one person, he's been living in Washington, D.C. for 2 years, has a job for 2 years now. Only one person knows that his brother's even dead. And he told him he got hit by a car. So he has shared his experience with no one. He's bottled up. He's an accident waiting to happen. And we talked about that if you don't share this experience, that one day when you start a family or you date somebody that's important to you, how are you going to share that? What are you going to say? I wanted to tell you my brother died in a car accident. I remember I told you that, but not really. Or because if he comes over, if he brings his future bride to my house for dinner, you can bet we're going to talk about that. We're not going to hide from that. And he said, Dad, I'm embarrassed. I'm humiliated that I have a brother who committed suicide. It's embarrassing. Interesting way of looking at it. I can't tell him he's wrong. He's embarrassed. So our suggestion was you need to get some help. Talk to somebody. Who can we talk to? Now, he said, Dad, I'm not talking to a psychologist or a counselor because that's a sign of weakness. I'm not doing that. Only weak people get counseling, which we have a counselor in the room. I can tell you that's true. We know that's not true. We know it's not true.
How old is he?
24. 24. And he's trying to be macho. He's a hockey player, too. And so we're trying to get him some help. So he's about to start a new job at the University of Wisconsin. And we said they've got a lot of resources, and we'll work on him with resources, and his mom will work on him. But you could see how different kids react to that. It's a problem out there for him. He is at some point that he's either going to get in front of this or it's going to get in front of him. But he's going to have to tackle this issue at some point. He's going to either ruin his first marriage or ruin his relationship with one of the children, or when these kids become teenagers, he's going to be scared to death that one of them will do the same thing, and he'll overreact from the kids or just being very normal teenagers, but he'll be worried to death, worried sick. So I think that answers that.
Okay. Oh, we have
last question?
One more question, yes.
And then let me tell you what we're doing at the end to wrap this up.
I guess this is like along the lines of communication. When you mentioned that Jake, you know, how communicative. We have three boys, and through the teenage years, they weren't very communicative with us.
No, that's typical.
Right. It really is. But it gets scarier when, you know, college, you don't know what's going on.
Right.
I mean, that happened with our oldest. We had no clue what was going on.
I have that with my 24-year-old.
And I just wonder, you know, and I also think that with kids, too, there are trigger points. You said, like, he had broken up with the girl. In our son's case, the girl dumped him the night before the senior ball. And that started a downward spiral of depression and anxiety that was at 18. He's just now at 28 coming out of it. It's taken 10 years. So I think communication with boys needs to be further emphasized. And interesting that we haven't talked about drug use and how that.
Yeah, that's another story, which we're not going to do today. So it is very difficult with boys as. You know, I'll joke about that for a moment. So, again, the smart one, so to speak, who's in Washington, D.C., the one who's a high school valedictorian, I have to remind him to not answer me monosyllabically because I don't learn anything. How was your weekend? Fine. How are you doing? Good. Anything new? No. Should we talk about anything? No, I'm all good, Dad. I don't know anything. I could spend 20 minutes on the phone with him and I learned nothing. And it's very frustrating. I feel it. What you're saying, it's so frustrating when boys are terrible communicators. Jake wasn't. Jake was a boy who said, you know, when I finish, how you doing? What's going on? What do you do? He would say, so how are you, Dad? How's your job going? You know, are you successful? He asked me really good questions. And we had a holiday party just a month before he died. And we have some very dear friends that when we met in 93, when we moved to California. So that's Uncle Dan and Aunt Sharon now, even though they're not related. They've just been in my kids' lives since basically the day they were born. And so, and Dan, who's in his 70s now, was talking to Jake. And at the end, and they talked all night. So 2-3 hours at this party, they chatty-cathied with each other about all types of subjects there, and science and math. And at the end of it, Dan called me up. He said, I am so impressed with Jake that he's growing up. He's such a pleasurable young man. He was raving about him, how great he is. He was dead a month later. He was dead. And so the night he died, and you know the news immediately got out, and I was on the phone, and my wife was on the phone calling some people. The people started to come over the house. The police were there. The county chaplain had come over, and Dan and Sharon came over, of course. It's mostly silence in the house, but they're all there to support you because what are you going to do? And I had my stepson post on Facebook a statement because I couldn't do it. And Dan just, he sat there with his head in his hands. He said, I just talked to him a month ago, and it's the best conversation we've ever had in his life. I don't understand. So I don't have the answer for you. But boys are terrible communicators. Let me wrap this up, if I could, Patrick. Can I come on up here? One second. So from a charity, if you said to me, Elliot, how do I help out your charity? Let me give you a few different ways to help out. So one way is, as I said, we need arms and legs to go into school systems, to get bands, to get music departments. Generally, it's not the music director of a high school that's involved here because most of the kids who play in bands are not necessarily involved in high school music. They're different kids. They just are. They have the bands, but they're not in jazz band or marching band or whatever. They're doing their own thing. But we need to get in there, and we need to get in there with a recommendation, a positive experience, and we're thrilled to do it. And give you, and we could use legs and arms to help us get in there. That's the first way to do it. Second way, when you're planning an event, you need kids to come and bands to show up. So you need a location. We need to advertise for bands, which means you need access probably to music instructors that teach kids guitar and drums, because that's where that comes from. That's what kids are most interested in, guitars and drums. And you need to get advertising. You need kids to get to show up, which means you need local principals or local music stores to say, we'd love to help you. Again, that comes with recommendations. It comes with a personal referral. So we need that. And then if you do want to help out a charity, let me give you my money presentation for 30 seconds. Obviously, there's a donate button on the website. It's a charity. It's a 501c3 organization. It's all tax deductible. You could do that. If you're a golfer, our only fundraiser event that we do per year is golf. I'm someone who plays golf because I can't say I'm a golfer because that would mean I'm actually better than I am, and I'm not. But we put on a golf charity. I know a lot of people play golf. I've got some friends who are pros on a pro tour, and we do a golf outing. We're doing one on August 20th, and if you want to play golf, you know golfers, we'd love to have you play. We need golfers on that. And that's our only fundraiser we do a year. We've reached the point now, size-wise, that we've gone from the fetus stage to the infant stage, and we're going to hire a director starting in August, that we can have a director now. We can afford a director, which means it can go beyond my two arms with a board of directors and people that want to help out, and that's great. So we're taking these steps to grow as an organization, and by the growth, that means that, and I would never take a penny for the charity because that would be blood money for me. That will never happen, and I would take money. But what we do, the money that we're raising is to do more concerts with more handouts for kids, whether it be a backpack or some other vessel that we use that's better than that. But to reach more students in a very passive way, or parents of students, that's fine, and say, yes, I'm feeling this way. Let's get some help. I'm not the only one feeling this way. I don't want to tell my friends. I'm not ready to tell my parents, but I don't like the way I feel either. Those are the people we can help the most. Thank you very much.
Yes. Hey, that was wonderful, Elliot. We are out of time. I want to thank you all for joining us, and I hope you have an absolutely wonderful evening. Good night.